This is Deborah Beck, professor of ancient Greek literature in the Department of Classics at the University of Texas at Austin. My students and I are excited to welcome you to our podcast, Musings in Greek Literature.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 8 of Sophocles' Antigone in 2019. My name is Albion. I'm a classical languages student at the University of Texas at Austin, and I get to be your host this episode. Today, we're going to be looking at lines 384 to 414, but before we get too deep into it, I would just like to urge you that if you haven't already, to go please listen to the previous episodes. Not only do my classmates do a wonderful job at analyzing the characters and the themes of the Antigone, I plan on expounding on some of the things that they mention. It's not totally necessary for you to go back, but it could prove useful and really enjoyable for you. So, with that being said, a quick roadmap for this episode. We're going to start off by talking about, like, kind of the bare bones, the content of the text, what's going on in the play, what Greek is being used, etc., etc. And then we're going to talk about what this means and what's the point. And finally, we'll end with a brief talk about my teaching experience. So, let's begin. The little context for the scene we're going to be looking at. Just before, Creon had been made aware that someone has buried Polynices by a character of the guard who, being a part of the group who was supposed to watch the dead body, should know who did it, but knows absolutely nothing. Frustrated and angry, Creon then rants for a while about this whole conspiracy against him and plots to undermine his power, and he sends the guard away to find out who did it. But not before sending him, some colorful threats. The guard, who's now upset and scared, hurries off to go do as he's told, and presumably Creon leaves as well, leaving the chorus on their own to sing the choral ode called Ode to Man. And that leads us to where we are now. The guard returns once again, this time with Antigone at hand, and he's confident and he's triumphant, and he says, "Hey, Dad! Here she is, the one who's done this." But before he can get, like, you know, too far into his bragging, he says, "Alapu Creon, where's Creon?" He wants to make sure that the right people are listening. So once Creon comes back out to where he and the chorus are, the guard confidently acknowledges him in this peculiar fashion. His sentence structure and his word choice becomes very complicated and convoluted. Let's talk about some examples. First off, he starts this whole speech to Creon with this bold proclamation. "Anax," he says, "for mortals nothing is apomaton, a word hard to translate in English meaning something declared impossible by oath, abjured, or renounced." He then goes on to say, "Pseudegar epnoia tain gnomein." Literally, you could take it as, like, the thought falsifies the thought. For each of the words in the sentence, you kind of have to sift through the possible dictionary entries and see what fits together. Because Mark Griffith points out in his commentary, the words like epinoia and gnome are generally used interchangeably and mean the same thing, thought and judgment. But he offers a translation for the sentence. He says, "Second thoughts make a lie of intentions." Now, I don't know about you, but this seems like a stretch. I mean, there are some nuances in the roots of the word that give them, I guess, a different flavor. Epinoia coming from a verb to mean, like, to think on. And then gnome coming from a verb to mean to know or perceive. But, again, like I said, it feels like a stretch, and I think this is deliberate. Because this guard here is attempting something of elevated speech. But why? Because the thing that he is referring as apomaton is his return. He's not referencing the gods. He's not referencing a strong political office. No, he's talking about his return after being threatened and not wanting to come back with the same weight as oaths. And that's serious. He's giving himself airs that he's more important than a guy like Creon would consider him. And you can kind of see him pushing his weight that, like, what I'm doing, you gotta listen. In the statement he says, "Agar ektos kai par elpiras kara eoikin ale mekos uden eidone." For this outer joy, against all expectations, is like no other pleasure in terms of extent. I really like Kammerbeek's commentary on these lines, and it says, "A very remarkable zygmatic and pleonastic phrase." And that's the end of the comment. And like, yeah, it really is. He's really cutting up and stretching words that should be next to each other in order to get you to listen. The words ektos and kara go together, and so do ale and heidene. And yet, in both cases, they're separated by about 3 words. He's not finishing his thought until the end. He wants you to listen to him. And this brings us to, why is he doing this? What does it matter? Why is he speaking so elevated and just like showboating? And that brings us to lines 397 to 399, which is the end of this first speech, right before he tells Crayon about everything that happened. He basically says, well, now that I've done what you want, then I shouldn't be punished. I should be free from all of the bad stuff you talked about. And that gives us the guard's motivations. He's doing all of this to not be tortured and killed. He's presenting himself in this fanciful and confident manner because he's trying to be taken seriously as the guy who caught that terrible, terrible criminal. And he's also really pumped because this is his shot at being praised and saved from the terrible punishments that Crayon threw at him earlier. So when I first read this scene, I was reading it as a contrast to his initial entrance. In his first arrival, he's this comedic guy with like this hesitant and worried demeanor, and he speaks kind of irreverently towards Crayon, and you can tell he doesn't want to be there. He himself says like it's his unlucky job to be telling this stuff to Crayon. He doesn't want to be the bearer of bad news, and he wants to leave. And now here, we still have like this goofy guy, but he's confident and he has his own like elevated and fancy way of talking, but he also doesn't mind being there. He wants to be in front of the king who just threatened him. And he even says it's his Hermione, his gift from Hermes, his good fortune to be there giving this news. And it's also not even just about being a stark contrast like to himself, but the guard also works as a contrast to both Crayon and Antigone. He's not like them. For one, he's just a normal guy, just a dude in Thebes working as a guard for the king. He's not rich, he's not noble, he's just a dude. But he's also not the same in temperament either. He's not stubborn in his ways or in his attitude. Antigone and Crayon are rather one note in that way. They know what they want and they'll get it at no cost. And I don't think there's been a scene where their attitude hasn't been like down or heavy. So that brought up the question of like, what does this mean for the play? What is this guard, a terrible messenger figure, and this really super variable character? Why is he here? What is his appearance for? What is his function? And I didn't have any firm answer for this when I taught the class. I couldn't figure out why, like, he was there. I wouldn't know what he was doing. And then when we were discussing him, the class brought up that he wasn't as wishy-washy as I kind of pushed him to be. He's really focused on his one goal of self-preservation, and that idea really struck a chord with me. Here's this guy who, you know, is hesitant in the beginning because he doesn't want to be killed as the bearer of bad news. And then here's this other guy where he's selling himself up because he wants to be saved from the threats of earlier. So if this guard is like Crayon and Antigone in that he is stubborn and focused on one goal, then what does that say about the thing that makes him different? His ability to adapt to a situation to achieve what he needs. This quality of adaptability and malleability in the face of obstacles is so interesting, especially in this play where the two heroes, Crayon and Antigone, are just incapable of it. Antigone dies because she's unbending and unyielding. And Crayon, even though he like gives in the end and says that he did something wrong, it's too late to save his family or his luck. Everything falls apart for him. He's too late. But then we have the guard. This average Joe, this comedic goofball of a man, against all expectations, par albatross, seems to be the one who you should be more like. It's just this quality of being able to look at the obstacles in front of you, to assess your situation, and to adapt accordingly that is so important in not only self-preservation, but achieving what is necessary, what is wanted, just in living. And I for sure did not expect this random guy in this play, who seems just kind of thrown in at times, to be the one to be most relatable and also surprisingly the most well-equipped to handle the chaos of Thebes in this play. But that's just how it is, isn't it? You don't need to be rich or famous or have this really interesting background or come from a good family to be able to thrive, to survive, and to live well. And I think that's kind of what the guard's doing. He is making the best out of the situation. And in order to do so, you gotta bend a little, you know? And that leads really well, actually, into my teacher of the day experience. I had really went all in on planning because I wanted to be prepared for whatever it is that happened. So I translated my section a bunch of times. I went into 3 different commentaries to make sure I was on track. I spent what felt like forever in a dictionary, and I made sure to write myself a bunch of notes of what things meant and where I wanted to go with discussion so that I wouldn't forget. But then when I got in front of the class, I saw that there were a number of obstacles that I did not plan for and had to find a solution for just on the fly. For one, I got so nervous that I blanked on things that I wanted and couldn't find it in my notes. So that was one thing that I did not think would happen to me. I did not think I would get stage fright. And then when it came to managing class time, I had completely underestimated that, and I spent longer translating on a small section than I hoped, so I had to figure out which lines to bounce around to and which ones to skip. And then when it came to discussion, it was not at all like having a conversation with, you know, a few people or even managing, you know, a small group academic discussion. It's a lot more involved and something I realized that I really don't know how to do. Despite all of that, though, I had a really great time teaching. Everyone was engaged and helpful in my forgetful moments, and it was rewarding to hear everyone's thoughts and opinions on the things that I was bringing up. It was also really interesting to see the room from the professor's perspective. Well, I knew it was no simple feat to teach a class, and it's pretty obvious, I think, that there's a lot of skill and preparation to do it. But it didn't really sink in until I dived in, and I'm really grateful that I had the opportunity to do so. You know, the only way to really know how to improve yourself is to find out in what ways you're weak, and this gave me the chance to figure that out. And there you have it, folks. This has been episode 8 of Sophocles Antigone in 2019. My name is Albion, and I really hope you enjoyed listening as much as I did speaking to you all. If you liked this episode, or just like the podcast in general, please be sure to leave a comment or share this with your friends. Please stay tuned in for next episode, where my classmate Peyton will be taking the reign and talking about the rest of the guard speech. Thanks for listening.